This is Back Talk by Successful Black Parenting Magazine, the most listened to podcast for parents by parents.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to Back Talk by Successful Black Parenting Magazine, the first national magazine for parents of Black children. I'm Janice Robinson Celeste, your host and publisher of Successful Parenting Media. I want you to tell all of your friends and followers about the show. After all, sharing is caring. Know that our hashtag for the show is hashtag BackTalk. Now, today, we're joined by Dr. Gregory Vecchi, and we're going to be discussing how to talk to kids about active shooting situations and what parents need to know. So let me bring Dr. Vecchi into the studio. There you are, Dr. Vecchi, and we're going to share the screen. So tell me, well, let me just tell people about you, what I know so far, what came over to me. Now, you have over 30 years of law enforcement experience, right? You're a U.S. Army vet, retired special agent and chief of the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, right? Career hostage negotiator. Okay. Now, he investigated but all kinds of violence, kidnapping, organized crime, drug trafficking, domestic terrorism, motorcycle gangs. I would say you are qualified, more than qualified, to discuss school shootings with us. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome. Thank you.
No, thank you. So how did you get into this topic of school shootings? That you're, I know you were the director of training at Safe Defend, mm-hmm. but how did you get into this area of protection?
So in my last couple years at the FBI, last 4 or 5 years, there was a focus of the FBI on understanding and dealing with active shooters, active killers, and things like this. And they did a lot of research in partnership with the U.S. Secret Service, and put out a number of, trainings and things based on these type of offenders. And so, you know, being in the behavioral science unit for the years I was, the thing that kind of set us apart, you know, kind of different from other FBI units and things like this, is that we focused on understanding the behavior from the perspective of the offender. And we found, you know, over time, you know, back in the 70s, when we started with the serial killer investigations, it basically started out where we were looking around, and not me, but my predecessors, of course, you know, years ago, kind of made this the statement, you know, we talk to the offenders, right, in terms of, you know, charging them, interrogating them, and, you know, building the case and victims and witnesses and things like this. And, you know, we look at crime scenes, but we really haven't talked to the offender as to why do they do it. And so they did, their first research project, which was basically going into the prisons. It was just haphazard, talking to these serial killers. And surprisingly, the serial killers and the serial rapists told them and were very happy to tell them exactly why they did it. And so that kind of started this whole movement within the behavioral science unit over the years to talk to the various offenders. And so when I came into the FBI's behavioral science unit before I was in charge of it, because I was a hostage negotiator, my interest was talking to kidnappers and hostage takers and things. And, you know, and so I focused on that. And then basically just for me, it was just kind of a natural, you know, move into looking at the active shooters, the active killers, and the targeted violence, and, you know, finding out that they're very different, you know, from other types of, you know, violent offenders. And so one of the things that that I try to bring to the training, and what I try to bring when I'm asked to speak, like on your show, regardless of the topic, if it's tied to the targeted violence, active killers, active shooters, and I'll get into that a little bit more, I imagine, as we talk, you have to understand the offender in order to best train to work against that offender. And that was kind of the logic of it. And so I was working these type of cases towards my end of my FBI career. When I retired, I decided to do this full time and work on threat assessment and prevention, you know. So I've been in that arena for quite a while. And then about 3 years ago, I found an opportunity with Safe Defend, and that's the company I'm with now. as their director of training. And so what I try to bring is, you know, both response and prevention aspects to the training based on an understanding of the offender, best practices. I've got a doctorate degree, so I'm all about the research and statistics and making sure that it's real, right? That we're not just doing stuff just because, you know, and then trying to make it work. And my focus is not really on the police. I have trained the police, but I find that, you know, the training that needs to be done with the police is very different than a kindergarten teacher, right? Or a student or a counselor or someone who's not law enforcement or security or a veteran. And so almost all of my clients and the research and the training that I do is just for the average person without the expectation they have any training whatsoever. And the idea is, you know, doing that if, you know, God forbid an attack would happen, what do you do? How do you do it? How do you prep your kids for it? How do you do the drills? Because there are there's so many myths and ineffective things going on. And I understand you were a teacher, and I'm sure that maybe some of the drills that the police ran scared the heck out of you, right? And that's not the way to do drills. And you do have to talk to your kids. You can't ignore it or just, you know, ignore the conversation, because they know, they see. It's in video games. It's on the news. They talk about it. They talk to, it's, you know, it, they know. And it's kind of like when you have a gun in the house, right? If you try to keep it a secret, then it becomes an object of interest, right? That can lead to tragedy, you know. But anything else, if it's looked at and treated as a, respected as a tool, or you decide not to have one in the house, you know, you just need to let the children know where they stand on everything. I'm having difficulty hearing you.
You mentioned I was a teacher, and yes, I definitely was. I was a high school teacher for television production kids, and I taught television production at two different high schools. And usually those rooms have no windows because we don't want natural light coming in like back here because you can't control it, right? So no windows, one door in and out. And I always wondered what would happen if we did have an active shooter at our school. How would I protect these kids? Because I was vested, you know, these are usually 4-year programs. So a lot of these kids were with me from freshman year to senior year. I knew them really well. I knew their families. I knew their issues. And I felt very protective over them. So I understand how a teacher can stand in front of her class and put her arms out as if she's a shield and to protect her class. And the only place I could ever think of was we had this little attic space where I could store equipment that if I could get them up there fast enough, maybe they wouldn't know we were there. But to try to keep an entire class quiet, even high school students, is almost impossible, is what I found out. Yeah. So I don't know how well that would have worked, but I'm really curious about the behavioral aspects of what you found for these active shooters. Like, what are they thinking? Is it different every time? Is there a common thread? It seems like for the high school students, to me, is a lot has to do with bullying. They were bullied all their lives, but not everyone that bullies goes and shoots up schools and you know, grocery stores and churches. So what's going on here?
Well, you know, you bring up bullying and that's just another form of grievance. And so what we found out on all of these attackers, and it doesn't matter if it's a child, if it's a high school student, it doesn't matter if it's an employee, someone who's elderly, these type of shootings and attacks happen as a result of an unresolved grievance, essentially. And so when you look at all of these cases, or the next time, you know, you hear of one, you know, how it starts out, you know, there's a news flash, we don't really know what's going on. And then as time goes on, you kind of learn the story on it like this. And one of the questions that, you know, you always ask yourself when you first hear about this is ask yourself, what's the grievance? In K through 12, and I think we'll focus on that for this discussion because it's slightly different in other areas, but in a K through 12 environment, about 91% of the attacks is going to come from a current or former student. Okay. It's not going to be the crazed serial killer, right? Or the stranger or the child molester or things like this. It's almost always going to be a current or former student. And typically, it's a result of a grievance. Okay. And so you got to look and say, well, what do we mean by grievance? Well, bullying is certainly a type of grievance, right? Just as you said, and you hit it right on the head in terms of that's the most common trigger is an unresolved grievance to do with bullying. But essentially, grievance can be one of four things. It can just that they feel they're being wronged by someone or wronged by the organization. They could feel persecuted. That'd be like bullying. A significant loss, relationship, family member, things like that can trigger it. And also ideology. Okay. Like we see in that, you know, talk about terrorist ideology, rather that is religious, ideological, political, whatever. All of those are grievances, right? But the trick is, you know, in terms of, you know, who's going to be violent, is it really that you really have to determine, okay, is this a normative grievance or is this a type of grievance that exceeds their ability to cope and they have nowhere to turn for help? And that's the person who's going to attack if you do not intervene. And so I make a distinction. I did this in my research. I wrote a book on it. And it kind of comes from my experience as a hostage negotiator. And it's kind of very similar when you come upon a person who's barricaded, he lost his job, he catches his wife cheating on him, he grabs her, puts a gun to her head, takes her hostage, and now it's a barricaded situation. And then I have to go up and deal with that, right? Well, that person's in crisis, right? He had all this bad thing happens in his life. Now, it's no excuse for what he's doing. And it's not going to excuse any criminal action that he's taking and violence and things. But the guy's in crisis. And a crisis is just simply two things, right? One is that they can't cope with it anymore. And number two, they can't get any help. And in the situations like a barricaded, you know, husband and wife type thing, whatever, domestic violence or whatever it might be, that's a very acute or fast happening crisis that occurs very quickly and it escalates very quickly. When you're dealing with, let's say, a child, right, who is bullied, okay, it's kind of the same thing. He gets bullied. He doesn't like it. He talks to the bully. The bully doesn't stop it. He talks to his mom and dad. The bullying doesn't stop. He talks to his teachers. He does everything he can to get help. Well, at some point when he can't handle that anymore, he can't cope anymore, and he runs out of options, then he's now on this pathway to violence. And that's the fatal grievance or the crisis. Okay. If that crisis isn't dealt with, if it's ignored, if it's just, a lot of people just don't really know what to do with it, right? Then violence will become the answer. And that's step number two. And that's violent ideation and intent. That's when he targets, okay, I'm going to kill the bully. Okay. I'm going to kill my teacher. I'm going to kill everybody in the school if he believes that everybody in the school is responsible, just the school, right? So he's going to pick a target. And then he's going to go down this road of research and planning. He's going to get on the internet. Columbine is one of the most researched previous attack for K-12 kids that are contemplating this violence. They're going to choose their weapon. If they can't get a gun, they'll get a knife. So the gun isn't a factor here, other than the fact that it causes much more damage. We find out in K-12, by the way, is that about 40% of the attacks are not guns, they're knives, and about 60% is guns. So again, if you're planning for the gun, you're going to miss the knife. If you're planning for the gun, you're going to miss, you know, the kid deciding to run the bully over in the parking lot, right, with his truck, right? And so they'll go through the research and planning stage. They may have a hit list. They might have a safe list. They might get maps of the school, figure out what types of weapons, what types of ammo, what types of protective gear, you know. And then if that isn't handled, the crisis, remember, the kid's still in crisis, right? Then he moves on to the actual preparation and optimization. And that's the actual obtaining the gun, obtaining the ammo, obtaining the supplies, you know, doing dry runs, you know, seeing like what classroom would be the best to do it in. How can I get the most damage? What door should I go in? He may do, you know, checks where the cameras, do I want to set the fire alarm off so everyone comes in the hallway so I can shoot them? All of this, you know, optimization and preparation. Then if that isn't handled to that point, then we move over to a response and the attack has started. And the important thing with schools is that having a threat assessment team and understanding this process works extremely well, but very few schools have a good threat assessment problem, if any. And the ones that do, they focus on things like mental illness and guns and things that really are not correlated with the violence. They certainly enhance the violence, but they're not a reason for the violence. And then how do you stop it? Well, it's simple, right? When you are in crisis, or you know someone is in crisis, and you as a teacher, you know, especially if you have kids for 2, 3, 4 years, you know what's normal for that kid. They might be a little, you know, odd, right? Or they might be a little goofy and things like this, but that's their normal behavior, right? And so that's okay. When someone goes into crisis, their behavior changes. We call that concerning behavior. And that concerning behavior can be anything from being tardy instead of being on time all the time. Maybe he's all of a sudden interested in guns, never been interested in guns before. Maybe he leaks or says or indicates that he's angry at Johnny the bully, right? And maybe he indicates he wants to hurt Johnny or kill Johnny. Maybe he makes a direct or indirect or a veiled or a conditional threat, right? And understanding the differences between that. And so it's basically just a matter of training the teachers, training peers, training the parents, if they're willing, training the coaches, training the counselors, and everyone else who is close to your students, right? Because these are going to be the ones that are likely to do this. And so if you think of it this way, a kid is going to have a different relationship with everybody in their lives, right? They're going to have a relationship with a teacher. So for your kids, for example, you know what the norm is for them because you see them, you saw them maybe every day for 3 hours, for 4 years, 5 days a week or something like that. So you know what's normal. That kid is going to act differently in front of his peers, but they're going to know what's normal for them. They're going to act differently in front of grandma and grandpa. They're going to act differently in front of the SRO, the school resource officer, right? But the thing is that within those relationships, every one of those people know what's normal for that given kid, right? So when they go in the crisis and things start to change, that's what needs to be reported. And then if you, and so you have essentially training that you can do for the observers, right? Because it's basically observed behavior and reporting concerning behavior and then knowing what to do with that concerning behavior. Because we don't want to have false negatives or false positives, meaning that we say the kid's going to be violent and he's not, or we say he's always no problem at all and the next day he comes in and hurts people, right? So what we try to do on that is teach the observations, teach the concerning behavior, cut through all the myths and misunderstandings of that. And then you have a group of people, maybe the principal and the SRO and the counselor in a school who would then be trained on the actual threat assessment, and they can make sense of what's reported as concerning behavior. And if it's indicators of crisis, right, but no violent ideation, okay, you have 3 or 4 people that have several observations of the child in crisis because he's being bullied, that's stage one, and that's a low threat. And so that indicates then specific interventions that are reasonable, such as crisis interventions, sitting the kid down. At any point, if you can stop the crisis, you can stop the violence, because if there's no crisis, there's no motivation to hurt or kill people. And that's really the key here. It's not, magic ball or crystal ball or anything like this. It's just understanding behaviors, because everyone, when they're in crisis, acts in the same manner. It just might be a little bit different if it's a school environment or a work environment. And so I would say that in terms of prevention, this threat assessment approach on observed behaviors and making sense of those observed behaviors, reporting those observed concerning behaviors, and then intervening immediately will stop that that path towards violence. As they get closer to the shooting, right, or as they get closer to the violence, the time compresses and it's less effective. So the most effective area to focus on is in the beginning, when the child is experiencing a crisis, and not ignoring it and not judging it, just reporting it. Because you as the teacher, the SRO, the counselor, the peers, they know concerning behavior because they know that child. And it's not their job to determine if it's real or not. It's the threat assessor's determination. So those type of concerns should be reported and documented, and then it can be actually analyzed, and then you can get do a proper intervention to stop the violence. So that's essentially, and that's probably more detailed than you wanted, but that's essentially what these offenders go through. Now, with children, it's a little bit more urgent sometimes because they have no life experience, right? Like an adult does. So their coping mechanisms sometimes are not as good as an adult. So they go in the crisis quicker because they have no coping, right? And so again, if they can't cope with it and they have no one that's going to help them, or they believe no one can help them, violence is going to become the answer if they go on that pathway to violence. And then they're going to go through those same four stages. But it's very simple. It's basically crisis, violent ideation, research and planning and preparation, and then you got the attack. Now, this is not 100%, right? Because you can miss things, right? This is never 100%. So you always, again, and I guess that might bring us to your other questions I have that you have for me, right? Is what happens when the threat assessment doesn't work, or you have no idea that it's going to happen, right? And so then what can you do?
Right. Let's talk about that part in a minute. But let me switch to the victims, because I heard a little girl who was out shoe shopping with her mom say to her she didn't want the light up sneakers. And her mom can understand why. They're so cute. Why don't you want the light up sneakers? They light up pink. Because, mom, when they have school drills, sometimes they turn off the lights. And if I am walking, the school shooter is going to see my light up shoes. That broke my heart. Yeah. Okay. So how can parents approach the topic of this active shooter type of situation with their children without causing more unnecessary fear or anxiety, I should say, because the school can do it all by themselves, depending on how they carry it out.
Yeah. So, and you bring up a great point. I noticed that on your advertisement, you have like the five questions to ask kids. And I'm going to break it down in two questions for kids who are 5 years and older, and three questions for children who are under five. Mm-hmm. So the first off is we need to talk to the kids. Okay. Now, obviously, if they're under 5 years old, or maybe they have some sort of a disability or something, you have to figure out which approach is best. But, typically for children under 5 years old, you basically want to let them know that they're going to be practicing to stay safe in case something bad happens at school or something scary happens. Right. Now, we don't have to say active shooter or killer or blood or guns or anything like this. It's just, look, you're going to be doing some practice with your teacher, and I'm going to help you also in case something scary happens at school. That's number one. And number two, let them know that they may have to practice sitting and staying in one area, or maybe walking really quickly in and out of school. And they might have to sit or kind of hide, for long periods of time, and that's okay. And also the fact is that they're going to be scared, right, if this happens. So you always want to focus to say that, look, your teacher is going to be with you the whole time, and you listen to the teacher, and she's going to make sure that you're okay and that nothing can happen, right? You just follow what she does. And then tell them, encourage them that if they have any questions, for you as the parent, to make sure to, let them know that you're there to talk. Now, whatever questions they have, now a kid under 5 years old is more than likely isn't going to have a whole lot of pointed questions like they would if they were in middle school or high school, things like this. But the idea is that you can't be silent on it, and you got to prep them for that. In these situations, kids are looking for leadership, and the person who's with them, the adult that's with them, more than likely their teacher, okay, is going to be the one that they're going to turn to because they're going to be scared. And so we want to make sure that they know that we have their back, that we're going to be there to protect them, and we're going to keep them safe. But in order to do that, you just have to know that this might happen, but it's okay. What I'm telling you, right?
Yeah, you froze for a second, but you're back. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. What did I miss?
Oh, no, not much, but go ahead. We can catch up. Go ahead.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that, you know, for under 5 years old, just because they're under 5 years old doesn't mean you don't talk to them. That's a mistake. I think okay. You've got to let them know that, you know, in case something scary happens at school, there's going to be some drills or things that you have to practice, and the teacher's going to help you and teach you to do that. And I'm going to help you also. And these drills, you know, these things that you might be doing is sitting or standing for a long period of time or walking really fast, you know, out of the school and things like this. And just know that if that happens, it's okay. And we're going to have practice. And if you have any questions, you know, make sure you let your teacher know, and you make sure you let me know. So that's for little kids, right? For the older kids, 5 years and older, again, this is just a guide. You're going to have to kind of determine based on the maturity of the child. But typically the older children, you basically let them know, look, you have fire drills, you have tornado drills, or inclement weather drills, whatever you call them, wherever you live, hurricane, tornado, depends on where you live. And there's also active assailant drills, okay? I avoid using active shooter or active killer. I don't think that's necessary. You can maybe even use a different word, whatever's comfortable for you. So I avoid the, you know, the words, you know, saying things like guns and killing and blood and death and all the other stuff. So I avoid those words because it's not necessary. It's just unnecessary. So you let them know they're going to have fire, tornado, and active assailant drills. And that these are going to happen several times a year, and let them know that, look, this is to keep you safe. Teacher knows what she's doing. I know what we're doing in terms of the practice, because if something bad happens, you know, we want to be able to stay safe, and leaving it pretty much at that. Now, the older children are going to ask questions probably. And if they do, you have a frank conversation with them.
Okay, well, that's pretty straightforward. I want to ask your opinion about this. I've seen there's some states now that are holding parents responsible when there is a when their child is the shooter. I just saw something recently about that, and
that was a Crumbly's. That happened on the Oxford. I think it was the Oxford High School shooting where they provided the gun to him,
right?
Knowing that he was contemplating doing that and things like that. That's a really unusual case, but you know, it's one of those things where, at least in that case, what it seems based on what I saw on it, like this, it wasn't like it was a surprise. Mm-hmm. You know, the child had lots of indicators that he was had a grievance, that he was going to be violent at school. He wrote it in drawings and writings and things like this. The parents, you know, bought a gun for him, gave a gun to him, and all the other stuff. As it turned out, they were convicted very, very quickly. I mean, that was a very, very, you know, quick jury decision. So, you know, as far as, you know, should that happen or not, and it's a matter of opinion. But if you know that your child, I mean, there is some responsibility, I think, for parents. If you know your child needs help and you don't get them help, whatever that is, then you're failing, you know, and you got to report things. And it's just one of those things where, you know, in that case, you know, he had clearly mental illness, clearly, you know, suicidal or homicidal intentions. It was directed at the school. And so those threats were there. They knew about it. They ignored it. They joked about it, right? There's some texting and stuff where, you know, she says, well, if you're it's what everyone do with the guns. Okay. Just don't get caught. Something like that.
Right. I remember that.
It was a real extreme situation.
Yeah. So let's go back to what you were saying earlier. What happens when everything fails, the child, the system fails, and now they are ready to act out on all of their idolizations of shooting up at the school. So what happens at that point? What do we need to do as parents and adults and teachers?
Okay, well, first off, this is really going to be in the responsibility of the school that to have the drills, to do the drills properly, mm-hmm. right? And also then to, you know, teach the proper skills, right? So let's talk about the drills first, okay? Because we always talk about drills. So there is a there's a push out there in a lot of schools where they try to do these kinetic drills. So what I mean by that is they get a role player to be a bad guy and he gets a cap gun and they've got fake blood and they get people to play, you know, victims that are bleeding and they're screaming and all the other stuff. That is terrible. And if your school is doing anything like that with teachers, students, non-law enforcement, emergency responders, then that needs to be addressed by the Parent Teacher Association, by the school board and things like that, because that is not the proper way. All you do with that is all you do is you traumatize people and you're going to make them freeze. And they want you actually counterintuitive, because those type of drills are meant for the police, responders, EMS, and things like this. They want to do that for themselves. That's fine. And I think it's great when they come and use the school to practice what they need to do, but you don't want the teachers and the students to be part of that or to be watching that. And I give you an example. Okay. You know, how long has fire alarms been around? As long as you can, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So how often has, during a fire alarm, someone threw a smoke grenade in your room and lit a fire in the hall?
Exactly. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So why would you do that on an active shooter drill? Because that would be traumatizing. And here's the deal. Since around the 1950s, when fire alarms became part of the school building, right, and drills, no one's ever died by a fire or smoke inhalation. Okay, so that goes to show that, why do you think that, you know, blood and guts and yelling and screaming and guns going off is going to make you, you know, make the drill better or make you better to respond to it? It's simply not. It's going to traumatize you. Okay, what we do is walkthrough and visualization drills, just like you do with the fire drills, but they're very different. So the drills that we teach, that we look at, is basically broken down into three things, three different ones that you would practice. Okay, one are escape drills. Okay, how do you escape the danger? The second one is lockdown or evasion drills. Okay, and the third one is, you know, God forbid the offender gets into your classroom, how do you engage him, right? And you've heard of the terms run, hide, and fight. I'm not a fan of that because it sounds like you run, then you hide, then you fight. And it really doesn't give you any ideas on how best to fix that or how to work that. There was a terrible, and just as an example, it was a horrible thing that happened. I think it was back in 2018. There was a newspaper gazette up in Washington, D.C. And this was a workplace violence situation. Mm-hmm. They wrote an article about him. It was a newspaper, and he didn't like it. And he went through all manner of things trying to get it taken care of, right? He went letter to the editor, tried to get retractions. He tried to sue him, and they refused to retract it. That was his grievance, right? So he exhausted all of his things, talking to the police, trying to sue, trying to talk to them, and it became a grievance, right? That was unbearable for him. So after 6 years of trying to resolve this, he finally was out of options, and he went in there and ended up killing five people. Now, here's the sad thing on the five people. Okay. We had one of the victims knew to run away from the gunshot. She found a door and the door didn't open and she froze, because she never thought anything past what happens if I can't get out of that door. She always made the assumption that she would just go out that door. And when she went to that door, she couldn't open it. And she was shot and killed just doing this with the knob. She just froze. We had some other people, three other people out of that five, that didn't understand barricading and didn't understand cover versus concealment. And they basically hid under a table that the shooter could just see right there, you know, that they were under, and they killed him. He killed them. And then another lady decided that she was just going to take it upon herself to attack the offender, and she was shot and killed. And so that's the reason I'm not a fan of run, hide, and fight, because it doesn't really teach you anything. I prefer escape, evade, and engage. And so part of those drills is basically it's a checklist, right? And it's like anything else. And I love checklists because they're simple. They're easy to practice. You can keep them laminated. Heck, you could put them on the wall if you wanted to remind you, or put it in your pocket. And the best example I can share with you on that is airline pilots. What do? Before they take off every single time? They run through their checklist. And it's always an emergency checklist, right? In case things go bad. What happens if the engine goes out? What happens if we lose navigation? What happens if we start plummeting towards Earth, right? What do? And there's a checklist for every single one of those. We provide Safe Defend as a checklist for those three activities, or those three responses, escape, evade, and engage. And so, and I'm happy to, provide this to you if you wanted to give this to your audience, but it works really, really well. And I'll just give you just a couple examples. I'm reading it right now, because again, if you have a checklist, there's no reason to guess. Use the checklist. The first one is have an escape route prepared in your mind, and think about things that normally you wouldn't consider exits, like windows or emergency doors that have a alarm on them, right? Before you escape, look and listen. Okay, don't just run out of your room. Listen, look left and right, then left again, just like you were taught growing up crossing the street, right? Also know your alternate exits. You don't want to be like that poor lady that died because she didn't think beyond the fact that, what if I can't get out this door? You want to leave your personal items behind. If you run out, you don't want to have things that a police officer might mistake as a gun or a weapon, right? Because they don't know who the bad guy is when they first arrive. You want to be, I guess another thing is when you're thinking about escaping, one of the most important things to do is listen to that little voice in your head. Don't wait and think, oh, was that a gunshot? Oh, that couldn't have been a gunshot. Maybe that was a firecracker. Because that hesitation gets people killed. The other thing is that when you're running, you want to keep at least 8 feet between you and the attacker, and if they've got a gun, and that makes it very difficult for them to shoot a moving target, and you also want to zigzag. So this is a practice thing you could do too. You don't have to run necessarily, but even just kind of walking it, right? And then you want to have a place to go. Once you leave your school, you want to have a safe place to go. You don't want to just stop in the middle of the parking lot, because then you're a potential target and there may be a secondary shooter. And so we don't want to group outside. The other thing that's really hard for people is that if you run into a wounded person, keep running. Don't help them, because if you stop to help them, then not only are they going to probably get killed, but you and all the kids you're trying to protect are going to get killed. And so those are just some things to keep in mind on escape, right? If you're going to hide, or evade, or lock down in the classroom. So let's say you can escape, right? And you just feel that hiding is better. The first thing to do is have a lock on your door. There's never been a school shooting where a shooter broke through a locked door to get into and hurt kids. It's always doors that are left open, propped open, or they don't have a lock on them. Because we understand the offenders, right? The offender goes up to the locked door. Okay, they're not gonna mess with it. They're gonna go to the door over there that's open, and that's the classroom that's gonna be targeted. So we want to make sure you have a locked door that locks from the inside. Once you lock the door, you want to have heavy items like a bookcase, or something. You can move yourself, right? Not too heavy, but heavy enough that you can put the barricade, maybe to cover the window if there's a window on the door. And then you want to move away from the door, because even though the door is locked, most doors, unfortunately, especially with rifle rounds, the rifle round will go right through the door and will hit you or your kids or your students. And so you want to move away to the safer corner. And the safer corner is just one of those corners that, and I say safer because there's no safe corner, but a safer corner. And that really depends on where it is. And so I don't know if you can see me, but let's say that I am the bad guy, right? So let's say somehow I open up the door to the classroom, okay? And let's say the door is close to a corner right here. Okay. Well, yeah, you obviously can't go here, but when I open the door, the first corner I'm going to see is this one out here. You don't want to be there. The next one I'm going to see is that corner over here. The last one I'm going to see is this one here. This is where you want to be. You want to line up there. Okay. That gives you an opportunity in time in the event that the, see, I'm the bad guy and I get in there, time that you can react and make me react to you in terms of if you need to engage me. Right. The other thing is understanding cover versus concealment. Right. Cover is something that will protect you from bullets, like an engine block or a cement beam or something like that, or a pillar or something like that. Concealment will just basically protect you from observation. So if you're hiding behind drywall, for example, that would be considered concealment, because that's not going to stop a bullet if there's a gun fired on the other side. And it's important to know the difference on that. You want to turn the lights off. You want to turn off the sound on your telephones, on your smartphones, and things like that. So there's your checklist on that. Now, worst case scenario is if you have to engage the offender. Now, one of the things that we always emphasize is we never ever suggest or train a teacher, a student, a counselor to go after the bad guy. Because when that has happened, it almost always results in tragedy. What we're trying to prepare you for is to ambush that attacker if he enters the room that where you have the lockdown. So let's say you didn't have a lock on the door and he got in. So you're what we call is protecting the threshold. So you see a barrel, an arm, a leg, a head, or anything that crosses the threshold of the door into your room or through a window, you see any body part or aspect of the weapon, then that's what you attack. And you attack it with ferocity, and you attack it with improvised weapons. What we offer at Safe Defend is actually an entire system for that. So you don't really have to think about it, and you got ready tools to deal with how to deal with bleeding after it's over with, or until help arrives, because blood loss is a big problem usually from the gunshots. And also we give them pepper spray and batons and strobe flashlights and tell them how to use it, you know, more than throwing a can of beans at them, right? Much better than that. And basically, you know, if you have older students or you have staff there with you, you give them a job. So while you're waiting, so you barricade, you go off to the safer corner. If by chance the bad guy puts his arm in there, right? Well, someone has the assignment to take care of that right arm. All they do is focus on destroying that right arm with anything they can, right? Someone else focuses on the head. Someone else focuses on the right leg. Someone else focuses on diverting the barrel away from anybody, right? And what happens is that in understanding the offender, and here's what's kind of interesting, right? These offenders are just as scared as you are when they're making the attack. The thing is they're cocky because they think that they're going to win because they got the gun. And when they come in expecting you to be there and they're not, and they come in expecting you to be there and they're not, they're going to look around. That gives you the ability to take the initiative and stop the attack. And so that's just some ideas of checklists for escaping, evading, and engaging the attacker. And then, you know, giving the students, giving the teachers, even the parents, the confidence to know that, you know, they're prepared and they got the confidence to know that it's going to work and the practice to do it. The only thing I could say on you know, making it better in terms of technology is one of the things that we offer at Safe Defend, which is the purpose that the company was formed. Our company was formed about 11 years ago by a guy named Jeff Green. Now, Jeff was a former teacher, and he was a high school principal. And after Sandy Hook happened, he decided to devote his life to making the classroom safe. And he developed the concept of Safe Defend, and it's basically a notification and protection system. And so we have a, we're in like, I think 11 or 12 states. We're in dozens of schools and businesses. And so what we do is we take the burden of notification of trying to tell somebody we need help off of everybody so they can focus on keeping themselves and their kids safe. And the way we do that is we have boxes and modules that are put into the classrooms and in the hallways. And they're like, it's like a fire alarm. It's hardwired. It's dedicated just to that. So let's say that I was a teacher and I hear a gunshot and I've got the safe defense system and I'm in my classroom. Okay. So I put my finger on the sensor and automatically information 911 is notified and everybody in the school and anyone else the administration wants to add gets a text and an email. So 911 and everybody else gets the following information. Number one, who set it off? Where it was set off at? What classroom? What floor? What building address? The name of the school? And the nearest outside door, so when the police arrive, they have a starting point. Now, if you can think about this in big, you know, districts where they have multiple campuses, right, and hundreds or thousands of kids, right, this gives everybody a heads up. But the nice thing about it is that only the people who are programming the system can set it off. We don't let the kids in there, so they can't go and set it off and do false alarms. And then so what it does then, and of course, there's a siren that goes off and there's lights that go off. So everyone's notified and everyone now has the same information as to what's going on. So then they can then focus on protecting themselves and their kids. So what it does is it takes the burden off of the person from trying to fumble with their cell phone and try to dial 911 or make a call or get on the intercom. Because here's the deal. Your life's in danger. You're scared to death, right? And so we take that burden off of them. Anyone can be taught to do this, and this is what that's all it is. Okay, that's the first part of the safe defense system. The next part is that there's a, when you put your finger on the sensor, there's a cabinet that's attached to that sensor in your classroom. So I touch it, the alarm goes off, everybody's notified, everybody knows where I'm at, what's happening, et cetera. So now I just focus on, okay, now I need a barricade and I need to protect my kids. A door pops open automatically and a go bag comes out. And in that go bag is pepper spray that shoots 21 feet and it's gel. So if it's windy, if you happen to be outside, it won't go back in your face. We also have an expandable baton that also has a glass break so they can get out, break the window and use the baton to clear the glass to step out if it's on the first floor, or use the baton against the body parts of the offender if they're trying to come into the classroom, right? And it's very devastating, right? I mean, it's a steal. I mean, it works terrific in terms of self-defense, and a strobe light where you can blind them. And there's also a kit, which we train a tourniquet, hemostatic gauze, which is kind of like quick clot, right? Mm-hmm. And then pressure bandages, right? And we train them on how to basically keep someone alive until it's over with and EMS can come in and get them to the hospital and get them the proper care. And so that's the protection piece for Safe Defend. But the thing is, the bottom line is that as far as the response piece, right? You can do the escape and evade and engage with or without the safe defense system, but the safe defense system gives you better tools and a better way to notify and take that burden off of you as the teacher so you can focus on staying safe with your kids.
Yeah, I like that idea. I think it's needed in all the schools. Matter of fact, a version maybe even for your own house because you never know who's breaking in. But no, that's fantastic. I remember as a teacher, my door only locked from the outside. So I felt, wow, how safe is this? I have to open my door to go to get my key, first of all. To go outside, turn the lock to lock, then shut my double doors, which were flimsy anyway. Worry about how we're going to hide. And I had thought about all those things. What concrete walls do we have? Where can we? I mean, I should not have to think about these things as a teacher, but you do. And I mentioned to you before the show that we were on lockdown because of Marjorie Stonewall Douglas High School when they had their infamous school shooting. And we had no idea what was going on, and only because of the cell phones that the kids figured it out. But we weren't that close, but we were still on lockdown. We were close enough. So it's pretty scary, but we're running out of time. I could talk to you all day. I want you to reiterate the five critical questions that parents should talk to their kids about regarding active shooters. If you can break down simply for them really quickly.
Sure. So for kids that are 5 years and older, you basically let them know that you're going to be doing not only fire and tornado drills or fire and hurricane drills, but you're also going to be doing active assailant drills. I would avoid saying active killer, active shooter, anything that, you know, death or destruction type stuff, just active assailant. They'll know what you mean. And that the drills are going to happen several times during the school year. And to make sure that, you know, they you tell your kids that, you know, take it seriously, right? Because just like a fire or a tornado, these are serious events. Let them know that they're not in danger, that they're going to be, the teacher's going to help them. Teacher's going to explain to them. You're going to explain to them, you know, what these drills are. And so if something bad happens, you know, you're prepared and you got to practice. And like I said, it's no different than any other drill. For kids that are under 5 years old, frame it as, you know, the just warn them or let them know, hey, look, you know, sometimes we're going to be practicing some things in case something scary happens at school, right? Or something bad happens, right? And so what you're going to be doing is sometimes a teacher might have you practice sitting or standing for kind of a long time, and you might be kind of bored, but just know that, you know, that's going to happen. But it's just practice in case, you know, something scary happens, and you might have to walk quickly somewhere too. But the important thing is that your teacher is going to be there. Follow what the teacher says, and you make sure that if you have any questions, you know, you let mom and dad know also, and because we want to be there to help you also. The idea here on these talking to children is giving them enough information to give them some expectation. If they ask for more information, give them more information. And then also the other thing I would say as a parent is make sure you know what's going on at that school. Know what the drills are. Have them share the drills with you, exactly what they're doing. And if they're not following these best practices, then I would make a complaint. I would push it, and I would make sure that they're doing exactly what they should be doing, because they are the steward of your children during the day. They're there to protect your children, and they should have the best protection available.
I agree with that 100%. Many years ago, maybe about 8 years ago, I guess, you know, people really weren't doing a lot in the classrooms for active shooters. And we asked our preschool/elementary school what they were doing for preventing this, or in case of an active shooter. And I kid you not, they told us every teacher has a box of big rocks to throw at someone if they were coming through the door. And all I could do was, what? What? Yeah. Are you kidding me? Yeah, the kids will pick up rocks. No. I don't want my daughter, anyone picking up rocks and putting themselves in the line of fire. So that was a while ago. So hopefully they're not at that school anymore, but hopefully they have evolved with their techniques of how they would prevent and manage an active shooting. But yes, I'm glad that you said that it's important that the parents know what is actually going on. And, you know, we're going to have you come back because you were awesome with all of this information. And like I said, I could ask you 10 more questions, but I have to call it a day. So I want you to tell people how to get a hold of you guys at Safe Defend, and give us information about your website, et cetera.
Sure. So our website is www.safedefend, all one word, safedefend.com. And my email is greg dot Vecchi, V like Victor, Echi, at safedefend.com. Feel free to reach out to me. I'm happy to share information. You don't have to buy our system, but the training is well worth it.
And I'll make sure we put all that information under the video. The video will be available right after we end this session on our Facebook page. If you guys want to share it with people, please do. Dr. Vecchi, thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
I appreciate you. Stay tuned. Hold on. We're going to talk about listening to us for the next time, guys. We're going to be having shows every Thursday, same time. Sometimes they'll be pre-recorded, but most of the time they will be live. And just in case you didn't know, you can always leave a comment on our Facebook page underneath the video, and we can see those backstage if you put them up early enough, and I can put them on the screen so that we can answer your questions. So thank you guys for participating and listening to Back Talk by Successful Black Parenting Media. And we're a syndicated podcast and live stream talk show for parents. Don't forget to follow us by going to our website at successfulblackparenting.com. It's full of great content to help you to thrive and not just survive as a parent, okay? So until next time, I wish you all the best and much success. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to Back Talk by Successful Black Parenting Magazine. We'll see you soon.